Welcome to an episode of Reproductive Real Talk, where we delve into important topics surrounding reproductive health and inclusivity. My name is Dr. Colby Dundee, and I use she, her pronouns. I am a clinical assistant professor for internal medicine and pediatrics at the Brody School of Medicine, as well as the associate program director for our combined internal medicine and pediatrics residency. I run our adolescent medicine clinic and also help to start what we call our Pride Clinic that provides primary care services to the LGBTQ plus population here in Eastern North Carolina. Today we will be focusing on LGBTQ plus family planning, specifically addressing the unique needs and challenges faced by this community in the reproductive health space. Joining me today is Dr. Brandon Yates, who is an obstetrics and gynecology fourth year resident here at ECU Health with a passion for this topic and recently got some exciting news about what his future holds. So welcome, Brandon.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Dundee. I'm very excited to be here today. Yeah, I do have some exciting news. I recently accepted a position in Indianapolis at Indiana Health, where I'll be pretty much providing gender-affirming care, and including the hormone therapy and the gender-affirming surgery for the patient population up there. I'll also be working with residents and medical students up there, so I'm really excited for the next chapter after I complete my residency training.
Yes, fantastic. Well, they are lucky for sure to have you, and we hope that one day maybe you'll be able to bring all those skills and talents back here to Eastern North Carolina. But that's fantastic. And again, just so glad that things worked out in your busy resident schedule for you to join us today so we could talk about this important topic. So if it's okay with you, I'd like to go ahead and get us started, and we'll start with our first clinical scenario. So Jay is a 20-year-old non-binary adult assigned female at birth who uses they-them pronouns. Jay recently decided they wanted to present more masculine and is interested in starting low-dose testosterone to help accomplish this. They present to your office as a referral from their primary care provider who was uncomfortable starting testosterone in a person with the ability to become pregnant. Jay is initially very reserved, commenting that it was hard to sit in the lobby of your OB-GYN practice with all those pregnant ladies, where they felt like they were being judged and gawked at. So to start off, could you maybe provide us with some insight into the challenges transgender and gender nonconforming patients may face when going to an OB-GYN provider to discuss fertility and family planning, and maybe what are some ways that OB-GYNs or other providers can help them feel more comfortable in this setting?
Yeah, so this is a good place to be starting, because going to a doctor's office for anyone who's, let alone not transgender or doesn't identify within the gender diverse community, can be pretty daunting. It can cause a lot of anxiety just going into a doctor's office. And so now adding on the component of being transgender or gender diverse, going into an OBGYN office, from which we know OBGYN offices are typically geared towards cisgender women, or they have some aspect of women included in the title, can be very anxiety provoking and often can be triggering to their gender intercongruence. And so there's a lot of things that providers can do to actually make the environment more inclusive and more comfortable for individuals within that community. A lot of it includes just kind of making the front desk staff, the nursing staff, billing staff, anyone who's going to be within that practice, comfortable asking patients about their pronouns, their gender identities, and also creating inclusive imagery within the clinic so that they're not just looking at cisgender women with like pregnant bellies. Mm-hmm. They're looking at people from different ethnic, racial backgrounds, and also different gender identities as well. So there's like a lot of different things. And one of the things I did want to highlight is the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has a really good committee opinion. It's number 823. It's called Healthcare for Transgender and Gender Diverse Individuals, and it helps to outline, gives providers the ability to be able to create an inclusive environment and kind of gives them different steps about how to actually go about doing that, such as including like a non-discriminatory like signage in the room, also encouraging like individuals to get safe zone training, because I know like in medical school, mm-hmm. I got safe zone trained, and we just had individuals from the LGBTQ center come from ECU's main campus to provide that training for us as well. There's a lot of different things that they can do to kind of help make it a little bit more comfortable for them.
Yes, excellent. Yeah. And I know definitely ECU's Jesse Peel Center here is a great resource to community providers as well as practices here in the area to provide that safe zone training in it. But there are alternatives online that folks can do as well. So I think that's great. Thank you for that insight. And I love to hear, you know, that there are some resources for folks available online to be able to help follow and help make their practices more inclusive for this population. So thank you for that. Yeah. So let's kind of continue on. So we got past the initial part. We've made our environment and our office more inclusive, and we're helping Jay feel more comfortable. So after some reassurances, Jay opens up and mentions that they are in a monogamous relationship with a cis male partner and is interested in having their own biological children one day, but not right now. They want to know if starting testosterone now will affect their future ability to have children, and if so, what options are available to them? So I guess maybe we'll start with just that question first, and then we'll dive into the rest.
Yeah, so testosterone will not affect their ability to achieve a pregnancy in their future, specifically in regards to individuals who identify as transmasculine or trans men. They're able to take testosterone and it shouldn't have an effect on their future pregnancies. However, we do know testosterone is teratogenic, so we would obviously counsel the individual like, hey, we recommend discontinuing testosterone in your future pregnancy so that we avoid any potential complications affecting your growing baby. But in regards to that, there are different options available for them if they do not want to carry the pregnancy themselves, so such as surrogacy, or if they do intend to want to carry the pregnancy themselves, there are things that we do need to obviously go over as well, like carrying the pregnancy can cause a lot of physiologic changes within your body, and that can also be pretty triggering to your gender incongruence as well. But there are different options for fertility assistance. And some of those that are available are just the same ones available for cisgender individuals, such as insemination from partner or donor sperm, the ability to do in vitro fertilization, and also potentially could do like oocyte preservation or testicular preservation as well. So there's a lot of different options available that are the same options that are available for cisgender individuals too.
Perfect. Yeah, thank you. And what about if they want to know, you know, Jay also just is curious to know if being on testosterone is a reliable form of birth control for them, and if not, maybe what options would you maybe suggest in this case?
I'm glad we were talking about that, because testosterone is not a reliable form of contraception. And so all the options of contraception for cisgender individuals are available to individuals that are transgender or gender diverse. One of the things we do have to discuss are the slew of options of contraception. So I like to go through the most effective to the least effective for all of my patients, because just because you're on testosterone does not mean you're not able to conceive a pregnancy. So you need to be on something that's going to be reliable or something that you are going to be comfortable with, because we have our progestin options and then we have our estrogen and progestin options. And so sometimes patients may question, can I be on an estrogen or progestin option even though I'm on testosterone? And actually there's no contraindication. So they can be on estrogen or progestin, but we know being on any type of estrogen hormone therapy can also be triggering into their gender incongruence. And so a lot of patients tend to opt for progestin therapy.
Yeah. Great, yes, excellent. All great advice for sure. And so I think, you know, I think that's been very helpful in kind of giving us a good idea of the options available. So now to kind of hone in a little bit more, I'd like to maybe consider just another case of a same-sex couple, Sam and Anna, who are both cis females in a monogamous relationship. They want to expand the family, but they're not really sure what all the options are available to them. And they come to your office just looking for more information. So you already kind of touched on a few of these different reproductive technologies available for same-sex couples, but what can you touch upon just kind of some of the unique needs and when it comes to family planning and maybe some other options available?
Same-sex couples may face challenges in accessing assisted reproductive technologies such as intrauterine insemination, also known as IUI, or in vitro fertilization. For example, a lesbian couple may need assistance from a sperm donor or a fertility clinic that specializes in LGBTQ plus family building. It's essential to provide them with information about their options and supporting them throughout the process.
Yes, definitely. And I think it can, the other thing that I think to consider and maybe bring up, and I don't know if you've had the ability to do this, we do this a lot in primary care, is talk also about like adoption and fostering, which can also be a really great option for same-sex couples who maybe don't feel the need to be biologically connected to a child, but know that they want to expand their family. And so I saw some data recently. The U.S. Census data actually showed that LGBT parents are 4.5 times more likely to be raising adopted children than heterosexual parents. And same-sex couples are also 6 times more likely to be raising foster children than heterosexual couples. So beyond kind of the carrying the child and, you know, going through that whole process of, you know, having, you know, harvesting oocytes, freezing them, sperm donation, all that kind of stuff, there's other options available to folks to be able to have a family that sometimes we forget to talk about.
that's a good point, because I know, like, even for like patients that I see in clinic for fertility consults, sometimes we forget to mention that option, because a lot of the times individuals are wanting to have biological children, but it kind of takes some time to kind of encourage them, like, there are other options out there if you're not able to have biologically related or related children. And then so that would definitely be like a good option for same-sex couples as well.
Yeah. And then I just wanted to quickly touch on, you mentioned that you work in the fertility clinic, obviously, as a resident, and this is going to be a big part of your future at the next step. And so can you touch quickly, and maybe you might not have numbers and that's okay, but just kind of globally the accessibility of some of these, like, you know, reproductive technologies, and like what maybe just globally, like what does it take to kind of go through some of this process, or cost wise maybe, if you know what insurance will cover, what they won't.
Yeah,
it's a loaded question.
Yeah, so like as a OBGYN resident, we are supposed to get that reproductive endocrinology type rotation in our training. And so as a resident here in Eastern North Carolina, we actually recently lost like our reproductive endocrinology and fertility specialist. Mm. So a while ago he was doing IVF therapy, but they lost funding for it. So that option was no longer available in Eastern North Carolina. So unfortunately a lot of the patients are getting referred to the Triangle area, like Raleigh, Durham area, to be able to get that, have that opportunity. And I don't know the exact cost, but I'm not entirely certain if insurance covers it. They may, but I know it's pretty expensive and costly for IVF. Mm. And then IVF, like some patients have to go through multiple rounds because it's just a very stressful time and process for like the family. So I know it can be pretty expensive. And there aren't too many REI specialists out there right now. And so if they are, they're at like major academic institutions. Mm. It's gonna be really hard for individuals in like rural communities to get that access or get that care.
Yeah, definitely something that we've experienced here in Eastern North Carolina, and especially helping our transgender and gender diverse patients find a provider in one of these areas who is, you know, affirming and safe for them. So that can be an extra burden, an extra hurdle for a lot of our patients here in this area. But can you give a sense of, if we did have a patient here in Eastern North Carolina who, you know, we don't have that any provider available to provide that here in our area, so we would send them off to the Triangle, what does that look like visit-wise? Do you know, like, as far as going back and forth, or like how often would they have to go out there? Like, what would that burden look like for them?
So I don't know the specifics, but I imagine it would be pretty tough, because they would have to take that long commute, time off from work, expense for gas. If they already have children, then like childcare. So it would be like a back and forth process, because they would have to see them pretty regularly, like for appointments, checking hormone levels, or whatever process they decide to go through. I can imagine it'd be a long, drawn-out process.
Pretty intensive, yeah. Well, very good. So, I mean, it's very clear that navigating all these family planning options can be really complex, especially for our LGBTQ individuals, and especially our LGBTQ individuals and couples here in Eastern North Carolina. So what are maybe some steps that we can help others and help other healthcare providers take to ensure they are providing this inclusive and gender-affirming care here in our area?
Yeah, so I think the biggest thing is healthcare providers should take the ownership in educating themselves. There's so many different resources that are available, like the standards of care through WPATH, transgender excellence, like through UCSF. Mm-hmm. There's so many different resources, and we can't rely on the patients to educate us. I think that's one of the things that often turns off patients that identify within this community, is that they want their provider to know how to take care of them versus the patient teaching the provider. And which is correct. Like, I wouldn't want to be educating my doctor about like how to take care or treat my asthma.
Right.
Like, I was like, I'm pretty certain like you learned about this in medical school, which we did. So I think that's like one of the first steps. And then just also like familiarizing yourself with a different terminology. Like, what does it mean to be transgender? What is cisgender? What is genderqueer, non-binary? How to use the correct pronouns? And also getting comfortable with apologizing for making mistakes. Mm-hmm. Like, if you just own up to it, like, sorry, I used the wrong pronoun, like, it's really easy, like, to make that mistake and just kind of acknowledge that when it happens and just kind of move on and just keep going on having just a normal conversation. And then the other thing is also just creating a non-judgmental environment. We are all human at the end of the day, regardless of our sexual orientation, gender identity. We all deserve the right to be treated with respect. So that's like another component of that. Just being a good human.
Yes.
Essentially, like sometimes, like it's not that hard just to be a good human.
Exactly.
And then just also providing like additional resources and creating like a support network for like your patients. Like if you don't know something, look it up, or maybe find someone you can refer them to so that they can provide that like adequate care. And if you don't feel comfortable providing the hormone therapy, or you don't feel comfortable counseling them on different types of like fertility sparing treatment or counseling them on contraception, like refer them to another provider who does.
Yeah, definitely fantastic advice. The other thing that I find sometimes, especially I've been trying to be more mindful of it and trying to encourage like our residents to be more mindful of it, and I'm sure you run into it in your field, your specialty, but just the use also of more like gender neutral, like body terminology and like gender neutral just terms for procedures in general. And so I don't know if you have any comments about that or what your experience has been like.
Yeah, because for cisgender patients, whenever we talk about their method of infant feeding, we often say breastfeeding. But for an individual who's even had top surgery, because they're still sources available for individuals who've had top surgery to chest feed, we need to term it as chest feeding versus breastfeeding, because we know breastfeeding, that can be triggering as well. And so calling it chest feeding, or addressing the parent, like not calling them mom or dad, because not often they want to be called mom, or they may not even want to be called dad. So just addressing them as the parent. Mm-hmm. And so that's like also things that we tend to forget, because we're so used to seeing like cisgender patients, like that's like what OBGYN has kind of defined itself as, like taking care of women or cisgender women. But now with ACOG and their stance, they're actually encouraging us to be using more gender neutral terms, and also just being more inclusive with our language that we use.
Yeah. And it can take practice.
Yes. It takes a lot of practice. Even though, like, even I will make mistakes, and I own up to that too.
Oh yeah, and all like, the time. Yeah. But I loved what you said, just kind of being open about it and being willing to apologize and move on. And I always try to remind myself and remind, you know, our residents and other learners that if you just mirror the language that the patient in front of you is using, you can really never go wrong.
Right, that's true.
Well, awesome. Well, I think that is all we have time for today. And so I just want to say thank you so much, Dr. Yates, for being here with us and sharing your expertise on this topic. I feel like this has been a really fun and great discussion, and I'm sure all our listeners have gained some really valuable information from it.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Denny, for having me. It's been a pleasure to discuss this important topic, and I hope it inspires more healthcare providers to prioritize inclusivity and affirming care for all individuals and couples.
Oh, definitely. And to our listeners, thank you all for tuning in. We'll see you on the next episode of Reproductive Real Talk.